This year, millions of students worldwide will take courses taught by the best American universities, but many of them will never set foot inside a classroom. They will study using massive open online courses, or MOOCs. Online classes are changing the way people learn. They're part of an ongoing debate about place of technology in education. Joining me now to talk about the future of online education, Anant Agarwal. He is the CEO of edX, one of the first online learning platforms. Amy Gutman, the president of the University of Pennsylvania. Joel Klein, former New York City Schools Chancellor, now CEO of Amplify. And Tom Friedman of the New York Times. I am pleased to have all of them here. Because Tom and I have talked about this, I'll begin with him. Is this, at long last, an idea whose time has come?
Definitely, Charlie. You know, I think all the forces of connectivity and interconnectivity have reached a point where we can now really not only dream about, but actually deliver the best teaching from the best teachers from a whole range of universities to people all over the world at a speed, scope, scale, and price that was simply, you know, impossible just a decade ago. A couple of little things I think they've got to still overcome. They're not little, but I think they're eminently overcomable. One is the security issue. Did that person who took the course take the test, et cetera? And I think they will overcome that. And the second is certification. Did you not just take the course, but did you learn something? And can we certify that you learned something? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone here will give you, you know, much more than I can about how they're overcoming those problems. And when they do, I think this goes to scale.
Sounds like a business to me.
It's much more than a business. I think even more than overcoming problems, I look at the opportunity. I think there are things that we can do with online learning technologies that can dramatically improve the quality of education. So, for example,
So the learning experience will be better.
It will be much better. In a regular classroom as an instructor, I know very little about how my students are learning. I have very little data. I like to view what we're doing with online learning. You know, I call edX a particle accelerator for learning, where we can use the data and get these analytics and research as to how students are learning. And over time, provide them with much more of a personalized learning experience over time. So to me, the real exciting part is the opportunity, much more than the immediate problems, which we will engineer and solve.
What are you doing?
We're doing this in a K-12, kindergarten to 12th grade. And what we're doing is a combination. First of all, what Anand said is absolutely right. We're taking data for the first time and using it to really inform instruction, to personalize it so that kids can get what they need, not just get the common approach. Second of all, we've got now a tablet that is being used in schools. It's a learning platform. It's not about the tablet. It's a way the teacher can control the classroom, orchestrate the lessons, get the content to the kids. And the third thing we're doing, Charlie, is building a curriculum that I think will change the world. And I think what Anand said is really powerful here, which is we need to use this to dramatically improve the teaching and learning experience in our classrooms. Teachers are embracing it, they're excited about it, and the kids are responding to it very, very positively. One of the kids we interviewed said, you know, education's got to have a factor of fun. That makes us learn better, gets us more engaged and more excited. And we can do all of these things. And the great thing is we're in the earliest innings of a game that's just beginning, but the potential is absolutely enormous.
Are you ready for this, President?
We're off and running and excited about it. A couple of things. To what Joel said, really important. It's not what we teach. It's what really counts is what our students learn. And there is no doubt that the learning experience of combining online education with interaction with your students is better for the on-campus experience. And at the same time, what we are ready for and our mission is going to be more fulfilled is the amplification of access. Access to some of our courses is expanding exponentially. I'll give you an example. Rob Grice teaches single variable calculus, not a sexy course, you would think. 50,000 students from 62 countries have signed up for it. And he's flipping his classroom at Penn and his students love it because what he can do online, he says, just makes the blackboard look dull.
So you're ready to give degrees?
We give degrees right now, Charlie, and it is not a substitute for the campus-based experience, but Rob Grice's course has just been certified by the American Council of Education, and there will be places that give credit for it, and we ourselves may give credit, you know, BC Calculus Advanced Placement credit for it. And that's just the beginning. In just this past year, just Penn, a 500,000 students have signed up for our courses, and it's just got huge potential.
Okay, just a moment to look at history. Why has it been slow coming?
Technology had to reach a point, Charlie, where you could simply get the pipes to a speed, a scope, and a scale, basically, where someone in India, in Egypt, in Africa would have the bandwidth, the regular electricity, and the cheap enough computer or tablet in order to participate. And what happened over the last decade is we got that amount of interconnectivity. That was a huge revolution, a great inflection. It was disguised by the subprime crisis and post 9/11. Yeah. Something really big happened in the plumbing over the last decade.
Okay. So what are the problems here?
So we should be totally clear about this. Right now, there isn't a business model for what we're doing. We're doing it because we're mission-driven. We believe, and Tom has said this very eloquently and forcefully, if we don't do it, we're going to be dinosaurs. And our faculty are really love it, and they want to do better. But there isn't a business model right now. Right now, we're funding this with the expectation that, given the demand, there will be. We'll be able to have a sustainability. We don't want to make money. We want to have it sustainable so we can drive the costs down.
Do you have someone who says, I want to endow a MOOC, you know, a chair in MOOC learning or whatever? Is that something that could happen in the future?
I think that's something that will happen in the very near future. That is certainly on my priorities list.
We're also exploring, a number of, as we speak, exploring a number of business models. I think our challenge is going to be not what is the business model, but which of many exciting business models to pick from. I'll give you one example. So we, with edX, we license our courses to universities where they use them in a blended model on their campuses. As one example, we licensed a course to San Jose State University in California in the fall of last year. And to very good success. Those are early results, but good success. So much so that the entire Cal State system and San Jose State University have decided to adopt edX courses in their on their campus. So 11 campuses this fall of the Cal State universities will be using an edX course in a blended model on their campus. And these schools, over time, will pay a license fee for these courses. So you can think of online courses as being, think of it as sort of the new textbook. I mean, it's not exactly, it's much more than a textbook, but think of it as a new textbook. In the past, people were completely comfortable adopting a textbook written by, you know, Tom Friedman in their own course. It's perfectly okay. So now I think professors will use courses from other places, and the task of the professor will be up-leveled from spouting content from the stage with their back turned to the class from a blackboard, but rather work with students, teach them ethics, teach them how to learn, but teach students how to process information. So we go from spouting content to processing information, and I think this will be a win-win for teachers and the students.
This is a critical point. I'm sorry.
Go ahead,
this is
the
critical point, because people will figure out a business model. I have no doubt about that. Exactly. The real question is, will you improve the learning experience?
Yes. Exactly.
And if we do that, we will have done something very exciting and very powerful. The potential is there, and you're beginning to see it. But simply because a course is online doesn't make it a better course, doesn't make it a better learning experience. And what we have got to do, and we're starting to see now, and people are starting to write about, how do you change the learning experience?
Exactly.
We can change the business model, and that's what's going to happen.
And it is got to be, if it's going to be successful, and I believe it's going to be wildly successful, very different from a textbook, because textbooks didn't replace or didn't even transform,
come close to it.
They're not interactive. And so if you're a math whiz, you can learn calculus from a calculus text, but very few people, that's not increasing access. So what these online courses can do, and the reason that this is the real wave that can make a difference, is they have interactive capacities. They have testing capacities. They have feedback loops on them. Again, not a substitute for all the other things you get in a campus-based experience, but boy, there are millions of young people who cannot have a campus-based experience. And so it'll enrich our campus-based experience.
Absolutely.
At the same time that it will, you know, increase access. And let me just give you one example. We all know about their kids in Swaziland who are now online, but there are also autistic college-age students who learn at Penn now through our online courses in American poetry and Greek and Roman mythology because they can learn better online than they can in the classroom.
Tom, you wanted to say.
Well, I was going to say, Anant's being a little shy because the example he gave that was taught at San Jose State, which I know about because I wrote about it, is the basic circuits and electronics course that MIT teaches. And I believe they had the way they did it was with a control group. So they taught the class one traditional way with a traditional professor in front of the class, and the other with basically putting the lectures online, the MIT lectures, and kids could, you know, watch whenever they wanted. Then when they came to class, the entire experience was working with the professor, and they got very, very good results. Mm-hmm. As far as the timing of all this, where we're at, I have two words for you, Charlie: Alta Vista. Okay, that was the search engine before Google. We're in the Alta Vista stage right now. We're in the Alta Vista. Google hasn't been invented yet, and you know, to Amy's point,
what might Google be?
Well, it might be, you know, I've had the pleasure because Joel shared with my wife Ann, as a teacher, and myself, his tablet.
Right.
It's like nothing you've ever seen.
Tablet.
It's just.
You bring it.
It's knock your socks off. You know what I mean?
Doesn't it say you're not paying attention when your eyes roam?
Teacher with one click says eyes on teacher. Right. I mean, it's a very cool device.
It's knock your socks off. It's something like you've never seen before.
So who can do it? Mm. Who can qualify? And do I have to qualify to take your courses? From MIT or Harvard
or Berkeley or UT Austin.
Yeah.
I think that's the beauty of it. And I think you hit the nail on the head. If you look at our existing education system, it is structured for people who already have something. So, for example, we have admissions into universities. You know, places like Harvard admit under 10% of their student body. Most universities admit a very small fraction of the students that apply. And those that apply tend to have good background already. Now, they're from generally well-off families that can afford to send them to SAT prep school. They've gone to good schools where they have, you know, they've had a chance to shine in athletics and so on, and universities look at a number of things. So therefore, just a small fraction of students can get into good schools. With what we do with online learning and MOOCs at places like edX and others is, I like to call it flipping the funnel. So rather than having an entrance test and admitting students into a really, really small entryway, what we're saying is open up the funnel. Anybody that has an internet connection and a will to learn anywhere in the world, geography is no bar, income is no bar, can come in and take a course. It's the ultimate democratizer of education. Come in, take the course, prepare as you go along, and if you can cut it, you will even get a certificate. I think it's the ultimate democratizer.
So think about this in terms of a place like Africa, what it can do for the continent.
Well, you know, Charlie, imagine we have AID that gives foreign aid basically for human development around the world. Their budget's around $14 billion a year. It's actually a lot more than people realize. Imagine what AID could do in a country, say, like Egypt.
Right.
In a MOOCs world, they could rent a room in Asyut, you know, in Upper Egypt. The room, put in 50 computer terminals, rent. We would pay for a high-speed satellite internet uplink, hire an English Arabic-speaking teacher to be a coach and an aide to students, and invite anyone who wants to come to take the best courses at Penn or at MIT. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, for pennies on the dollar, we would be able to leverage, give these young people what so many young people around the world who have been either in revolution in the Middle East or not in their countries really want. The potential, the ability to realize their full potential.
Exactly right.
You know,
it can unlock the future.
Yeah, it can unlock the future. So I'm very excited about it.
I think education is a basic human right. I think it can solve not just economic problems and provide opportunities for people, but I think it can promote world peace. I think there's also a really good opportunity for even in healthcare. On our discussion forum, when I was teaching the circuits course, which had, you know, incidentally 155,000 students from 162 countries taking the course, on the discussion forum one night I saw a student from Pakistan, a student from Egypt, Colombia, the U.S., New Zealand, having a discussion together on the forum, helping each other, solving each other's problems. Just imagine what the world is going to be like 10 to 20 years from now when these same kids grow up in an environment where they've helped each other right from the get-go.
Correct me if I'm wrong or not, but 155,000 students is more than all the MIT alumni in the history of MIT.
One of Andy's professors wrote about this. I mean, you can, you can get the greatest. Take the 10 best professors in the world. You know, take what Michael Sandel does on justice. If you've sat in on his class, it's a life-changing experience. Every kid in the world can now have access to Michael Sandel teaching justice.
It really is exciting.
It's so powerful. Yeah.
So what are you doing at Amplify?
Well, we're working with the K-12. The difference between, I must say, the university challenge is important, but it's so much harder in the K-12 because you can't just give a kid a lecture course, obviously. You've got to create content that's very powerful. So let me give you one example of something we've done. We've got some games now, and we know that the kids who play the games that are aligned with the curriculum, a game on science puts you literally inside the cell, fighting off viruses and all these. And these kids, we see, learn a lot
more.
That's
cool.
Visuals. Should be fun. Most of us went on in education because it was fun.
Mm-hmm. And the visual. Then we did this thing. We tested this with kids. Kids who are having trouble reading complex books, they now have the Common Core standards in America. One of the things which is important, we've got to get our kids to really read difficult texts. That's a big part of education. It's not easy. Kids get bored. They tune out. What we have found is we get great actors to read the first chapter with them. And they do it visually, and they get so excited. The guy who starred in 42, the Jackie Robinson thing, did the first chapter of Frederick Douglass. And we watch kids respond, and it's like you light up my life kind of experience. Oh, yeah. They then want to read the second and the third chapter.
Okay. You've had part of your life experience having to deal with teachers' unions and teachers. Right. What's all this mean for teachers?
Teachers
in public schools and today.
Teachers have embraced this, and if they don't embrace it, it won't work. The teachers are an essential part of this. What the teachers love about it is it frees them to focus on the things they want, and a point I non-started with, and gives them information and data. Remember, I know how hard a kid's working on a tablet. I know which lessons work for a kid, engage him, how much time she's spending, et cetera, et cetera. Teachers get all this information in simple reports that they can then use to focus the classroom, to ask the tough questions. So the whole thing, this is not one where it's going to be a we-they fight. This is one where it's going to be, I think, a win-win for teaching and for kids. Yes. Those are the solutions we need in K-12.
You need teachers to fill in the motivation factor. I mean, most kids and most adults are motivated not only by what's available on the technology, however great it is, but seeing the passion and the inspiration and the expertise of a teacher who can answer questions and ask
the next question.
But
there's always one more question that a great teacher can ask to push you further, no matter how many you build in. The great teacher says, now think about this. I mean, that's what teaching does. I always say the most important thing is when a kid leaves the classroom, is he thinking about the classroom or his date for Friday night? And you want him to be thinking about
it.
No, you want him to be
thinking about
it. I'll give you an example of an instructor from San Jose State. Khosrow Guduri is a professor at San Jose State, where they use the edX course on their campus. And when he began, he thought, as a teacher, I want to lecture. And now if in this blended model, I'm not going to lecture, what am I going to do as a teacher? But if you talk to him today, he says his life is transformed because now he gets a chance to work one-on-one with the students, ask them questions, and help them how to learn as opposed to standing in front of them, lecturing to them. So he's really sold on it.
That's a really good story because we have to acknowledge there are skeptics out there. And I like to give the example of the skeptic who said, this new invention is to be mistrusted because it gives the impression of wisdom rather than wisdom itself. And that was Socrates about, what was he talking about? It was a new technology, it was writing rather than memorization. And so he really thought if you don't memorize, you don't learn. And we found out you can learn from writing. And then textbooks came, and textbooks were going to put us out of business. But it takes an embracing of the new. And I have to credit our faculty for doing that.
What's the next step?
Well, there are two things that I think there's a certain sociology around this. So, Charlie, I think we need to keep in mind. And again, it's the same world that delivered you this platform that's allowing MOOCs is, I think, doing two other things. One, you know, I like to say it's a 401k world. I'm going to mix some metaphors here. Mm-hmm. It's a 401k world where everyone will have to take the bar. Mm-hmm. What do I mean by that? I mean, we're going from a world of defined benefits to defined contributions. So what's great about this platform that they've all described, it really works so many ways, but it requires a little more self-motivation. Mm-hmm. I got to go to Joel's tablet. I got to take Amy's course. Yeah. I got to, you know, do Anand's test. The meter just moved just slightly. And just like in the wider economy, we're going from a defined benefit world to a defined contribution world. And that, not everyone's up for that defined contribution world, not every student. So I think we got to think about how we coach, enable, empower those students for whom that self-motivation doesn't come so easily. At the same time, what's going on, Walter Russell Mead has a nice way of saying it, we're going from a world of from time served to stuff learned. Okay, it's what, you know, the business world doesn't want just to know your degree, they want to know that you really know it. And when I say everyone's going to have to pass the bar now, no matter what you do, you graduate from Penn, you graduate from Brandeis, you graduate from MIT, in the old days, okay, we'll train you, you got your BA, that was a signal, now we'll train. Nobody has time to train you. In a global economy, no one has the money to train you, everybody. So the workplace is increasingly demanding to know that your degree translates into real skills. Mm-hmm. So everyone's going to...
You're at least this good.
You're going to have to pass the bar whatever you do. And I think that's the big trend here that is also, I think MOOCs will serve that. But it's going to be a more demanding world in that sense.
I think you would agree, Tom, that passing the bar isn't what defines the best legal counsel.
Sure.
So the element of creativity and innovation that this is not sufficient for, but certainly gives a necessary base, a knowledge base for, and then you can spend your time as a student really becoming creative. Hmm.
I think that's
the upside. Yeah. That's the upside potential.
Can you also learn at your own pace?
Yes.
So that you want to accelerate, you can accelerate.
Absolutely. Or if you want to slow things down. When I was in college, I wasn't as smart as the other kids around me. And around the 5-minute mark, I would stop following the teacher. And then I would just be sitting there scribbling notes, trying to catch every word that the teacher said, and then hopefully catch up on it later.
Yeah.
And so I think for some of us, slow it down, and for others, speed it up. So I think learning at your own pace is a really key part of it.
Yeah, I want to highlight a point Tom made, because it's really important. People now are not asking, do you have a degree? They want to know the bank of knowledge and talent. And Amy is right, creativity is a part of it. One of the last things I did when I was chancellor was with Sam Palmisano at IBM, created a school 9 to 14. In other words, took a traditional high school, traditional 2-year community college, put them together, at the end of which you had to be literally certificated by IBM. Mm-hmm. They test your skills, and they look at creativity. You pass that test, you go to the top of their list for placement as an IBM technologist. And so that kind of model, a skills-based model, is going to replace a degree-based model over time. It's not going to happen quickly. And Tom's point, the other point he makes, which people who are watching should understand, we are at the Alta Vista point. This is so early in the game, and 5 years from now, it's going to look entirely different from the way.
Two things. One, aren't there some numbers I've seen in which a lot of people drop out?
So I think this relates to a point that Tom made earlier, which is, in my mind, the single biggest challenge we face is that of motivation and commitment, which is students will sign up when you're in school, your teacher, holds your hand and guides you through and asks you, have you done your homework?
Right.
Then kids go to college, and in college, they leave you alone, and there's some oversight, but not a whole lot. So you have to be motivated. Online learning takes it to the next level and requires a level of motivation which is much beyond what we require today. Now, today in classroom, you sit there, whether it's for better or for worse, you sort of swallow information.
Right.
Here, you have to go and pace yourself. You have to go and submit homeworks, and you have to motivate yourself. And I see that as one of the bigger challenges. And I think even though we have, in some courses, if the course is very rigorous, as rigorous as a campus course. You may see a 5% pass rate. But for other courses, you may see much higher pass rates. But what we're finding that in the blended model, where the course is offered in a campus, where a professor augments it, the results are, or I should say, potentially much better. In the San Jose State experience, for example, in our pilot study in the experimental course, the results went from a traditional 59% of people passing the course to 91% of people passing the course. And again, these are preliminary results, but I think as we learn more about the whole blended model, I think we will understand how best to motivate students in a much better manner.
What can be said about the difference in cultural learning experiences from country to country to country?
I think there's huge differences, and I think we're gathering a lot of data. We know where the students are from, and so we can actually study what the differences are. So, for example, we have data on the edX platform right now, and the paper is being published by my colleagues at various universities on where are students spending their time. So we know how much time they're spending on the textbook. We know when they do an exam, are they looking at the textbook, are they watching videos? When they do homeworks, we know whether they're watching textbooks or whether they're watching videos. We know exactly what resources they're using. And I think we can study from a geographical standpoint how different cultures use different media in order to learn. And I think by learning that, we could potentially, in the future, customize a learning experience based on cultures. You know, some cultures may prefer to watch videos,
right.
And some cultures read textbooks.
There, on of Coursera's courses, 60% of the enrollees are non-American, and I think from every country, there are now courses being done in Russian as well as English, but the great thing about online is that there are usually people on those courses who will translate for other people. I do think that the blended model is the one that we can say with certainty is revolutionizing higher education now, and actually K through 12 as well. I think it's still, we're not in the Google phase of the of purely online, because it takes an exceptional person to be so motivated and so creative to do something online and get the same thing out of it as you would get with having a master teacher.
Think about what Amy just said, though. It's very interesting that in a lot of these courses, like in Coursera, students do their own translation and put up their own subtitles for other students for free.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just we take it for granted. But it's Wikipedia.
Really helping each other.
Yeah, they're helping each other. It's just amazing.
And the thing in a K-12 space is really important is it is essentially a blended model. Because I think parents would be legitimately concerned if you said, "We're going to put all their kids on a computer," and leave them there. Instead, these are things that are happening right in the classroom with the teacher's ability to click and say, now we're going to move toward a discussion of this and off of the tablet and so forth. And it's that capacity and the ability to enrich it. Plus, extended day, extended year. We had some kids who are homesick, and now they can dial right into the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so they don't need
traveling
to miss a day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's always
powerful.
Going to be free.
So I think the free is not the key issue here. I think at the end of the day, there has to be a sustainability model for students, and I think the key question is that we need to focus on is, are we providing value? And if you provide value to students and they're getting a lot more than they are today, that's a good thing. And we would like to make our courses free, or maybe in the future peg the cost of a certificate to per capita or something like that. So there's a small amount of money that may come in. But at the end of the day, I think, if you want to increase access, we have to keep the courses free or very low cost.
Well, Anna, let's be clear. They're not free. Somebody's paying for these courses.
Exactly.
And the question is, what's the sustainable model? And I think there's not just one. I think there'll be multiple ways of making sustainable models here. One of the great things, Joel, about what we're learning about online courses, we're learning more about human psychology, too. So most of the courses now on Coursera and edX are not for credit, and hundreds of thousands of people take them. And we found out
for the joy of learning.
And we find out they're quizzes, and we find out they cheat. even though they're not getting graded and they're not doing it for credit, they want, there's some percentage of people who can't help but want to do better than they're actually doing.
So they convince themselves.
But you know what we do? We're getting great data, which will make a difference in how we move this forward in learning about how people best learn.
Yeah, these are the kind of things that really have to address. This is one more example of what the internet has achieved, which is personalization.
Yes.
Give you control.
Personalization, scale, but at a whole level of quality, you know, that you wouldn't normally have. And that's what's so exciting. I think one of the things it's also going to do, Charlie, for higher ed, and Amy and Anant can talk about this, is it's going to bring pedagogy back into the discussion. That is, you know, you need to actually get a certificate to teach kindergarten in this country. You need a certificate to teach second grade, but you don't need a certificate to teach physics, I believe, at MIT. So how good a teacher you are didn't really matter. You could kind of get up there, and I got tenure at MIT. You're going to listen to this, and you're going to like it or not. So it was more the castor oil. Sometimes you got lucky, like the math teacher that Amy talked about. Sometimes you got castor oil. Yes. But you didn't, now every professor, there's going to be a little competition.
How many are in your MOOC? And professor shopping.
I'll tell you my own story.
Yeah.
When I first joined MIT, teaching is a big part of our business. And so one day, you know, I told go show up at 11 o'clock and you lecture. And I go there and students are sitting in front of me and I'm like a deer in front of the headlights. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never lectured before. I've never taught before. And, you know, this is what we do today. And I think what online learning and MOOCs has really done is I think it has put education front and center of a national and international ethos. I think people are discussing it. Mm-hmm. I think teachers are becoming rock stars, and I think education as a field, I think, is becoming exciting. And I think people will pay a lot more attention to it, and I think that's a really good thing.
Now, what about the idea of accepting courses from other universities for a degree at...
So we already do it. Yeah. We accept transfer students from other universities. We have advanced placement credits that students get. Okay. So why not? It will take time. We don't know exactly how that model will work. But I think it's a real plus that faculty can see what else is going on in teaching advanced algebra. And it is constructive competition, because you can take Rob Grice's course and you can teach it as a course in a CAM and really supplement it by personalizing instruction for your students. And it, just on the hunger for talking about teaching.
How many college professors ever did what Joel had to do in his New York school system, which was show a great teacher teaching fractions to second graders to other teachers? Yeah. I mean, how often did that happen with college physics? You know, I doubt it happened very often.
And
Samuelson's textbook in economics may have been threatening the way textbooks were threatening at the beginning, but a lot of people use it who are themselves expert teachers. But these online courses are, I think, going to travel because there's no cost in them traveling.
Does this, back to the teaching importance, does this mean that what you teach and how you teach will be as important as how much you publish?
Well, you know, on a Friday afternoon, a sunny Friday afternoon this spring, we had a conference that Tom was so kind to speak at, and Martha Cantor from the Department of Education was there, and other Daphne Kohler of Coursera, and Britt Kerwin of the University of Maryland. There were 450 people from all around the world that came to talk about teaching, and even a greater number of Penn faculty and students were there. I can't think of another time where the topic was teaching that so many people came together to talk about something that's so exciting to them as well as to us as educators. And we don't know, I call it a bold experiment, because we really don't know how the experiment is going to work out.
I mean, I think
it's going to work. Something is already working. So it's not a question of if, it's a question of what.
There is also this. I mean, this is something that I actually believe in myself. There is much to be learned, not just from a lecture, but also from being able to eavesdrop on conversation. You know, so the idea of a gifted teacher being in the hands of a gifted conversationalist, you know, it can also be a place where stuff you learn becomes crucial. You know,
Go ahead, Anand.
No, you know, absolutely. I think you know, we haven't asked the obvious question, which is, you know, we should be teaching how to teach. And to put our money where our mouth is, you know, at edX, we created a course. It's called edX 101, which is an online course on how to teach online. And as part of that, you know, Sal Khan, you know, my old student from MIT, contributed a video to it, which is a Khan-style video, the tablet capture Khan-style video on how to create a Khan-style video. So I think we need to create courses to how to teach. And in many parts of the world, in India, for example, the Wipro Foundation is focused on teaching teachers how to teach and teaching, you know, bringing the gamification element into education. And I think it's not just for high schoolers or K through 12. I think gamification is important for college-level education. So on our platform, we have online virtual laboratories where students have this gamification angle where they can build up experiments and so on, like Legos, and they're having a lot of fun. I think gamification is good everywhere.
I think it's important that these online courses are not just those science and engineering and computer science. So American Poetry has 34,000 people signed up for it, and Greek and Roman Mythology, 54,000. And these are star teachers, Al Filreis and Peter Strzok. They're star teachers in the classroom, and they're also star teachers online. It actually does translate.
The focus on making teaching a better experience the classroom will happen at multiple levels. The first thing will happen, you said before, which is true, a lot of people are dropping out, but we'll learn pretty quickly which courses they drop out of more quickly, which they stick into, and why. What is it that this person's doing that's keeping kids engaged and taking them to the new level? And this is where we're going to open up an opportunity, because I always thought in the universities that I went to, the teaching was uneven. Some of it was really terrific.
Of course, that's why you have popular courses and not popular courses.
This is going to put a focus on it.
One last question about you and Amplify. Do you expect to move beyond K through 12?
That's a question we're looking at, Charlie. Right now we're so focused on K to 12 because it's such a huge challenge, and all the issues of really connectivity in the schools, partnering, change management for teachers. So that's right front and center. But there are a lot of other things we're looking at.
There's so much work to be done in K to 12. I hope you stick to it because it's so important. And you know, the better the teaching, the more advantageous it is to the students who would otherwise drop out.
Absolutely.
Excellent teaching is a hugely powerful motivator.
This discussion. I mean, places like Penn, really, we need to get more and more kids who come from challenged and disadvantaged families going to the great colleges. Right. And that's something that's a serious challenge we can help do.
And we're looking for those kids.
What does this mean for a place like China, where one of their national goals is to build between now and 2050 two great universities?
Well, you know, for China, as much as for Brazil, Charlie, as much for us, I mean, it's just going to give that many opportunities to see best practices at a totally different cost structure. Now, there's going to be a language, you know, issue as well. But, you know, your question really reminds me, Charlie, like, I shouldn't be at this table. I studied Arabic and Middle East history in college. I was a Middle East correspondent. Why am I here? Okay. I mean, it's I'm here because actually I write about foreign policy. I write about power. Well, you write about power. Where does power come? Power comes from innovation, strong economy, growing, you know, workplace. Where does that come? Comes from education. You know, that's how I got here. I got here working backwards. You know, they got here working forward. But we met at the same place. And so I've always said, you know, I wish actually I'd studied education in college and not Arabic Middle East history, because traveling around the world now, what I see is everywhere you go, it's actually the biggest foreign policy issue. It's what's China, Brazil, the Middle East, it's actually the number one issue. And you know what's really interesting? Everyone thinks they're behind. You go to Singapore and they're killing us on the PISA math test, but they think their kids can't invent a hula hoop. You know what I mean? And you know, you go to you know, Japan and they're all worried. China's they think they got this part of it, but they don't got that part of it. Yeah. You come here, you know, Johnny and Susie can't read, but Billy's got a ring in his nose and Nancy's got a tattoo on her left shoulder, and they just invented three new Apple iPod apps. Yeah, so we're all sort of working on it, but everybody's talking about it.
Thank you all.
Oh,
pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. See you next time.